Welcome to the NCO Journal's Sergeant's Time podcast, featuring informal conversations with leaders at all levels, where you'll have the unique chance to learn what makes them tick, what their leadership styles are, and what inspires them. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Brandon Cox, NCOIC of the NCO Journal, and with us is Chago Zapata, the managing editor. Today, we welcome Senior Enlisted Advisor John T. Raines III to our podcast. SEA Raines is the Senior Enlisted Advisor to the Chief of the National Guard Bureau, stationed at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. He serves as the Chief's Principal Military Advisor on all enlisted matters affecting training, operations, health of the force, and enlisted professional development. He began his military career in August of 1989 and has served in the Army National Guard and United States Army for over 35 years. His last position held was as the 13th Sergeant Major of the Army National Guard. And some of SEA Raines' notable deployments include Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Hey, thank you. It's an honor to be on the show.
I was wondering if we could start off by talking a bit about your past, you know, kind of where you grew up, what life was like there.
All right. And no, I grew up in Montgomery, Alabama. So you could probably tell with my accent that I'm from somewhere, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line, and you'd be guessing right. So I grew up in a middle class family. And during the time period that I moved in, you already mentioned how long I've been in. So that would infer that, hey, I got a little age on me, especially to still be serving. So during the time period I moved, I grew up in Montgomery, Alabama. You know, not a lot of people in my neighborhood aspired to go to college. You know, we're all going to be professional athletes or some way to do what we enjoy doing in life. So I grew up playing all sports. If it had a ball, you know, I could pretty much play it, and I was decent at most sports that had some kind of ball in it. My favorite was basketball. Spent most of my time at the Chisholm Boys Club in Montgomery, Alabama, which is where I met my wife at. She was a arts and craft director there, a little bit older than I was, and I saw her walk by to go keep score at one of my basketball games. So that's where I first met my better half. And we've been married for the same time period I've been in the Army. So I got married in June of 89. I come into Army in August of 89. And, you know, my mom and dad were married all throughout my childhood and got divorced later on in my childhood. And, you know, met my wife and off to the military service we went, and have been serving in some kind of status or some kind of capacity ever since we first went in August of 89. I have two adult kids, Ricky and Stephanie, 35 and 32. Got four beautiful granddaughters, ages 10, 5, 4, and 1. And they all live up here with us, or close to us, within a half a mile of us, in the National Capital Region now. So it's like a reunited family, being able to come to D.C. and do my current job, just which happened to be where my children and my grandkids live at. So that's a little bit about myself, and I'm guessing that we'll get into more about me as we go through the conversation.
I know we went back here, going back to the time that you joined, but as far as who you are right now, who do you have a story about an NCO who mentored you or who affected the way that your attitude towards leadership and the way that you handle those responsibilities?
Yeah, you know, I say we're probably a part of a little bit of everybody that we come in contact with, good and bad. Agreed. But I talk about two people, you know, and I would say I talk about them a lot, but I don't. I talk about them on key moments in my life, you know, and I reflect back. Usually at change of responsibilities, when you're assuming big roles, you know, and stuff like that. I really think about who helped me get here the most. And there's two guys that I usually talk about, and I give credit for that. And I'll tell you, when I get finished telling you about them, I'll tell you a cool thing that happened when I became the senior enlisted advisor to the chief on November the 8th. Those guys, one's named Sean Edge and one's named Ralph Borja. And both of them shared something in common. They both knew each other. Now, I did not know they knew each other until, you know, way later on in my career where it became apparent that they knew each other. But they both served in Bravo Company 375 together. I met Sean when I reclassed from a signal communications specialty to the infantry while I was in the regular Army. I got assigned to the 2nd Infantry Division and the 1st and 503rd, and Sean happened to be my roommate. So Sean had a lot of catching up to do with me. He had been sent over there from being in 375, then he came to Korea to 2nd Infantry Division. And he was the guy that really taught me how to be an infantryman. You know, so you when you talk about troop leading procedures, you talk about, those 8 troop leading procedures. You know, he was a master at troop leading procedures. He was a master at field craft, patrolling, and he taught me how to be an infantryman. And then fast forward to my time spent in the 101st, I was a squad leader got a first sergeant in named Ralph Borja. And back in those days, we operated, down a couple of squads in each platoon, sometimes just because of the manning levels of the organization. So it was not uncommon to find yourself as the senior squad leader being the active platoon sergeant. So I spent a good amount of time being the active platoon sergeant during the time Ralph Borja was the first sergeant. And I give Ralph credit for teaching me how to lead. And when I say how to lead, how to lead differently than what I had been taught previously. Previously, I had been taught, you do what I say, how I say it, when I say it. And it was a very direct, authoritarian style of leadership. And when I met Ralph, Ralph taught me how to treat people and how to get buy-in, how to extend your influence and those pieces. And Ralph also came with a spouse. Nuet. And Nuet took Karen under her wings and taught her how to be a good military spouse. She was a great spouse anyway. I would say pretty close as perfect as you can get to me. But how to do the other side and how to build teams when it comes from a family dynamic. So therefore, your families are involved in your service, which is way important. I mean, we say this all the time. We say, hey, you recruit people, they become soldiers, you recruit a soldier, but you retain the family. And I think there's some truth in that. And my wife learned that from Nuet. And I learned all kind of things from Ralph. The cool part of that is when I became the senior enlisted advisor, one of those two have been at a lot of my change responsibilities, a lot of my big events in the military, but it's the first time that I actually have both of them in the audience at my change of responsibility. And I always talk about them at every one. So both of them got to sit in the audience and hear me talk about what they meant to me, what they meant to my family, and what they meant to my service during my changeover becoming the senior enlisted advisor to the chief.
It always shows you how small world the Army really is after all. Same thing happened to me. I had a great squad leader who really developed me as a young soldier, went on deployment, spent a lot of time with him, ended up becoming my best friend pretty much, after we changed units, that is. And then, found out when I was going to drum that he was too. So it's always a small world. It's nice that you have those people around.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
You've been in the Army now for around 35 years, and you didn't come in thinking that you wanted to go to college or any of that stuff. So, I mean, with the path that you've taken, you've gone very far. Was there a defining moment early in your career that kind of set you on this path?
I'll go back to that time in Korea. When I reclassed from one career field to the other career field, you got to find your place. And when we come in, we go see a recruiter, you take some aptitude tests and they try to align your aptitude with something they think a match. So, they get it wrong sometimes, and you don't know what you would like about the military when you come in. So, you kind of got to go fill it out and see, hey, what fits me. And some people just never find that. I think the ones that stay in the longest are the ones that find that. And it gives them that purpose, that direction, that motivation. So I think, me going into reclassing as an infantryman, I think was a pretty big you know, defining moment in my career. It introduced me to some key people in my career, like we've already discussed, that set me on a good course, taught me some good things. Without that, you know, I don't know what I would have, you know, been. I don't know if I would have ended up staying in the military, or exiting the military to go explore another career field. It's just hard to say, but I would say that was a pretty, you know, monumental moment, pretty early in my career. I think I had been in at that point. I'd been in about 4 years. And I know it's hard to think about something happening at the 4 year mark that sets you on a path for a 35 year career. But I would say that set me on a pretty good path. But I would tell you there's another event too that I go back and I look at, because I was a firefighter. And when I got out of the regular army after those 8.5 years, I come back home. My dad was a firefighter. So I come back home to be a firefighter in Montgomery, Alabama. And I actually, you know, I actually wrote an article for the NCO Journal about that moment, 9/11, when I was sitting at the fire station. And that first plane, we were doing our roll call. It was right before our roll call because we were on Central Time, of course, World Trade Center on Eastern Time. And the first plane flew into the World Trade Center. That was a pretty defining moment in not just my life, but, you know, a lot of people that have served over the last 20, 24 years. We've pretty much been at war that whole entire time period. So that was a pretty defining moment for not just my career, but everybody who served in the last 20 plus years. So I would say those two stand out to me.
It's interesting that you bring up your Muddy Boots article, Sergeant Major, because I thought it was so powerful. The message that you packaged in such a way that it just hit home, because I was at the time a gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps. It's funny how my career up until I retired in 2009, pretty much kind of mirrored yours in some small ways, because I joined in 1989 in January, and I served in Desert Storm. That specific occurrence, you know, and the way that you grew from that, I think one of the things that makes a good leader is being able to self-reflect and admit that there are things about yourself that could be better. And I think if more people did that, I think there would be that many more better or good leaders. The fact that you put it out there, it's kind of one of the questions that we have, actually, that we usually ask our guests on the Sergeant's Time podcast is, have you ever made a mistake, and how did you grow from that? You got an interesting answer from one of our previous SMAs, answered that by saying, I don't make mistakes. That was kind of the way he answered it. But anyway, Sergeant Major, the reason I bring that up is because I thought that was a powerful article, and that kind of self-reflection is important to be able to do that. And what do you think about that?
Hey, I wish I could answer it the way that one of our previous SMAs answered it, you know, and say that, but I can't say that honestly. You know, I've made a lot of mistakes, and I would like to think I've learned, from all the mistakes I've made, and I haven't repeated the same mistakes, because I think that's when you start talking about mistakes, I think that's one of the characteristics you look for in the people that are going to, you know, progress in their military careers to levels of higher responsibility. You look for somebody that will learn from their mistakes, get better from their mistakes, and not repeat the same mistakes over and over again. So I hope that's one of the characteristics people see in me. But, you know, when we talk about the one that I shared for the Muddy Boots article, that mistake was one that, you know, I have to revisit that, you know, because that's one of, you know, complacency and, just taking things for granted. And I think the other thing I hope people got out of that article is that there's a difference between being a good soldier and being a good leader. You know, I was a good soldier. You know, I had mastered, the requirements to be a soldier, you know, but that's in our Army, that's an E4 and below, right? So, and we oftentimes we even write evaluations about people, and we talk about things that make them good soldiers. I think we ought to scratch all that off evaluations and not even be able to put anything that makes somebody a good soldier on an evaluation, because there's a difference in being a good leader and a good soldier. And that's one of the things I wanted to bring out in the article, because I was not a very good leader at that point in time, because I was not making my team better, and I was not making those around me better. I was plenty good, but you know, that's not what we do as leaders. You know, we're only strong as our weakest link. We got to make our teams better for whatever the team mission is. There's not a whole lot of individual missions, you know, long ranger missions in the Army. So, you know, so I hope people got that when they read the article. But, you know, but yeah, I've got plenty of you know, challenges that, you know, I faced, you know, growing up as young NCO, that if I had to do over again, I would have done them different, you know, but at the same time, you know, I learned from those mistakes and became the person that I am today.
I guess looking back now, were there any traits that you think you should have developed to become more of an effective leader back then?
You know, I think compassion. I think some of the things that Ralph Borja, you know, instilled in me, I could have learned them faster. You know, I think just knowing how to get buy-in, knowing how to recognize, you know, that emotional intelligence, you know, not just getting, you know, just focused in on whatever the mission is, and giving some people some options, letting people fail in training, making people, you know, step up to positions they're uncomfortable doing. Not always, you know, you're the leader, but you don't always have to be leading everything that your team does. In fact, if you want them to get better, probably step out of the equation and be a Joe for a little while and tell so-and-so, hey, they're going to lead here. And just let them learn from, you know, repetition and just let them do it, you know, over and over again. I think all those things, you know, we know it, but actually, you know, putting it into practice and executing it, I think, you know, is what separates, you know, the leaders that are okay getting the job done. Because most units I've ever been in, they accomplish the mission. So then you got to ask yourself, well, mission accomplished is not what separates good units and bad units and, you know, mediocre units. So what separates the good from the bad and the in between? It's how people feel about, you know, they're accomplishing that mission together as a team. It's how they come and how they feel about what you just did, you know. And I think that's the piece that I think I could have learned a little faster, you know, and put that into practice a little more often.
I would hazard to say to Sia that one of the things I discovered is that you have to find compassion, empathy. When it comes to those kind of things, you have to find the right balance because you still have to get the job done. You know, so there's always that balance. Yeah.
Yeah. No doubt. No doubt about it.
Otherwise they'll walk all over you. And then, you know, assuming that you're soft hearted. So once you find the balance and you're able to get the job done, and you know, that's when you get the buy-in too, when they see that you care, see that that you think of them and that you care about them, and then you have them buy in by you know, being invested in them.
Well, you know, I think you know, we can't lose focus that we need to challenge our teams to do hard things that they can't do by themselves. And you know, and you can't go out there and lead an element doing something hard and, you know, being a pushover. You know, I think sometimes people misunderstand compassionate for, hey, being, you know, soft and being a pushover. But I think if you're putting your team through the right paces and the right challenges, you get it right. And you build that team and you get that, you know, that esprit de corps that we're all in search of.
I wanted to kind of move in a different route here, Sergeant Major. What's happening out there in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and between them and Russia, one of the things that we have been discussing occasionally here on some articles is that, you know, the NCOs need to know what's going on around them, you know, because you'll never know where the next fight might be, you know, whether it's with our near peer adversaries, whether it's Russia, North Korea, China, whatever the case may be. I think it's important for NCOs to be informed, for them to be well read, for them to be educated, not just in you know, what it means to be a good soldier, but what our adversaries are doing. What are your thoughts on that? Are you doing anything with that as far as you know, in your present position, as far as what's happening in the world around us and preparing the enlisted force and the National Guard for the next fight?
I would say in everything, really. the next fight, you know, hey, what's the priorities of the current administration? We just had a changeover, you know, in administration. So what's the priorities of the new leadership that's coming in? We're led by civilians. How does that shape the future fight? You know, getting lessons learned from what's going on around the world, you know, and what we think our pacing threat China is going to do, what we think's going on, you know, in Ukraine and Russia, what our intel is telling us. We got a lot of people, you know, in that area to provide us feedback. We got, you know, the Center for, you know, Army Lessons Learned, where we can always get feedback. We're feeding that into our combat training center rotations. So we're in the middle of all of that. You know, in the guard, you know, I have a J3, I have a G3 on the Army side, an A3 on the air side. We're embedded in our services. We're constantly getting after lessons learned, trying to feed that back into, you know, our cycle and change our operational environments, seeing how our current, you know, techniques and procedures, you know, work, and giving people the freedom to change and do things different, experiment. So I think we're constantly doing that. But I think that communication piece, you know, it starts with me and my boss. You know, when it comes to the National Guard, it's not that we're the end all be all. I mean, we're getting information from, you know, the chairman, the Joint Chiefs, both of our services, the Air and the Army. And we're just trying to make sure that he has some one-on-one calls with the adjutant generals. I have some one-on-one calls with the C-cells in the States. I have some monthly touch points where we get after, you know, whatever the issue at hand is. If it's some kind of training deficiency, if it's we're doing a good job, you know, it's hey, what's upcoming events. I think those things are important, and you got to have a battle rhythm event that allows you to push that down and use the old 3-5 principle when it comes to leadership in the Army, you know, and that's, you know, effective span of controls, 3-5 people. So, you know, you can get close enough to 3-5 people to talk about everything you need to talk about, and they just need to get close to their 3-5 and them get close to their 3-5. That's the only way I ever get the information pushed out to 430,000 soldiers and airmen, you know, across the world, really.
That brings up a point. Again, I'm going to switch it up again a little bit here. I had a question about this here. You're the first Army leader to wear the rank of SEA. So could you tell us about that? And also, how did you kind of prepare for that? What did you prepare? Because your position is kind of unique in the fact that you are also the senior enlisted advisor for both the Army National Guard and the Air Force National Guard. So that's kind of a unique thing here. And, you know, how can you tell us a little bit about that? What is that like?
Well, I'm number 7, so it's not totally unique. It just took us a little while to get on board with you know, hey, recognizing the position for what it was. So it wasn't until number 6, he was air, that we actually formalized the position, you know, moved that in line with the other, you know, 7 principal enlisted leaders across the Department of Defense. So the one your audience is familiar with is Sergeant Major of the Army. So I got moved into the line, same line as the Sergeant Major of the Army when it comes to, you know, pay, when it comes to, special duty assignment pay, when it comes to positional colors, when it comes to protocol, when it comes to those things. So we've been doing it a little while. You know, these are 4-year statutory tours. So I'm number 7. So when I'm done, that'll be about 28 years. So it took a little too long to get us elevated to the same level. But hey, we have been now. And it doesn't matter if it's a soldier serving this position or an airman that serves in this position. We'll be good from now on. So how did I prepare myself for this? I think that me being close to it, being the Army National Guard, Sergeant Major for the Army National Guard, I was the 13th Sergeant Major for the Army National Guard, kind of allowed me to see my predecessor, you know, in action, see what he was doing, see what his priorities were, and how is that different from mine being the Sergeant Major of the Army National Guard. And I'll tell you a little bit about how that differs. Train, man, equip. If you wanted to throw a couple of words in there as my job as the Sergeant Major of the Army National Guard, that's where my focus was. Train, man, equip. It was not really operational. I didn't have a headquarters that was going to go to war headquarters. We were really focused on policy funding, and those things that get after train, man, and equip. So the difference in my current role is it's a little more operational. Not that I'm a warfighting headquarters, but when you start talking about the Guard and you start talking about our three, fundamental missions that we have, you go to warfighting, you go to homeland and partnerships. So when you look at those, I obviously the warfighting piece, that's pretty easy coming from being the Sergeant Major of the Army National Guard, because that was, we were the combat reserve of the Army. So we provided about 48% of the combat, maneuver strength for the Army. And that's what our primary role was, is to get ready for that. So then air is the same way. So the air has a more day-to-day operational, touch with defending, the air space of North America, to include the United States. So, but then you get into the homeland piece, we just saw the wildfires out in California. Before the wildfires in California, we had January 20th, the inauguration. None of that stuff happens by itself without, there being troops on the ground. So we had about 9,000 soldiers on the ground for the inauguration. January 6th, certified electoral college vote. We had to have soldiers on the ground. Before that, when I first come into the position, we had the storms that rolled through the southeast, most notably around that mountainous area between North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, that area in there of the mountains, everybody saw the devastation that was there. So that's very operational. You have units deploying with their combat gear that are going to deploy, in a defense to support civilian agencies, where we're in a supporting role, but it's a very operational piece. All of those that I just named, and we're used to doing that in the Guard. But as the Army Guard Sergeant Major, I wasn't very hands-on on those pieces, but as the SEA, I'm going to touch every one of those. So most of the time when something like that happens, me and the boss are just the boss. We're going to go to where the troops are on the ground, to encourage them, to see what their needs are, to make sure that they got what they need to do the job. Then you start talking about the warfight piece, and our just partnership, that other part of that mission piece. And that's both our international partners, other countries. That's our partners across the joint force. That's all of our partners. So I have to go and visit other senior enlisted, that we partner. And something called a state partnership program, where each one of our states has a nation that they partner with. Most notably, Ukraine is a partner with California. So one of Ukraine's first phone calls was not to the Department of Defense; it was to the California National Guard, who they had a 30-year partnership with. So keeping those things alive, making sure that we're being good teammates. Those are big pieces now. Getting back to how do you prepare yourself for that? I think just through the normal progression and normal assignments coming up, being a state sergeant major, being a CCEL over the joint force at the state level, and then being the Army Guard sergeant major, and then having some timeouts in there, going and actually working at a geographic combatant command where I was the J3 senior enlisted leader at, Indo-PACOM. So I think those things, they prepare you along the way. You don't wait till the day before and say, hey, I need to prepare to be the SEA. You prepare over, a long career.
There's a difference between the Army though and the Air Force, and there's like a cultural difference. Has that kind of created any sort of challenges for you, Sergeant Major, or is there anything there that, or is it pretty much they're so similar that it's just kind of in a way maybe blend together so that it's all the same challenges regardless of which branch?
Well, I think leading people is leading people, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're a soldier, you're an airman, you're a Marine. It doesn't matter. What's the root word of the definition of leadership? It's influence. So how do you influence people to do what you need them to do? So I don't think that changes when the mission changes, obviously the Air Force mission is different than the Army mission. So, but how you influence people you know, to get after either one of those stays. So I think if you stay in that lane and you're a joint leader, you're good. You know, obviously you want to know something about the culture of the services you lead. So obviously I want to indoctrinate myself and I want to learn from the air side, but I'm never going to consider myself the subject matter expert in Air Force, you know? And I think, you know, that wouldn't be real if I did that. They would see that, hey, well, you read that in a book somewhere. You obviously didn't grow up in the Air Force because you're dressed in the Army uniform. So, you know, although what you're saying is correct. So I think they, you know, as long as I stick to the people front and the people domain, it puts me on pretty solid footing. And I trust my Air National Guard CCM, you know, Command Chief, Master Sergeant. I trust him to lead that organization. I trust my Sergeant Major of the Army National Guard to lead that organization. And then, you know, I concentrate on the things that are in my wheelhouse that I developed over, you know, 35 years of being a soldier, but also in that 35 years of leading joint, you know, elements and learning the things that I just laid out for you and just staying in that wheelhouse of, you know, what we all share in common together.
What are some of the big initiatives or goals that you're looking at, you know, as you sit in the seat?
Well, you know, my boss has been working, you know, on his priorities. You know, we don't want to get ahead. We kind of came in together around that November time period. So we knew there was going to be a lot of transition of our civilian leadership at the higher levels. So we didn't want to get ahead. So we've spent a lot of time together. Well, we've talked about, hey, what are the priorities? You know, but we also, you know, I think he feels the same way I feel when you start talking about leading at the strategic level. If you come in and you just totally do away with the old and put in the new, which there are some cases where you may need to do that, but how strategic would that be if we just changed our thought process and what we focus on every 4 years? You know, that wouldn't be very strategic. So with that, there's some commonalities in where we set our priorities. But we agreed that, hey, we're going to start with people. You know, people are going to be the focus of everything. And then we're going to get after what he calls RPM, which is readiness, partnerships, and modernization. And then, you know, we're just going to spin in that RPM. If you think about an RPM being a tack commoner on, you know, on a car and just spinning around and spinning around, we're going to work on that readiness, partnerships, and modernization as much as we can in order to get as competent as we can, as ready as we can, you know, and be as lethal as we can. So therefore we project strength. And then hopefully, you know, the whole Department of Defense is in that same, you know, mindset. And then that, what's that produce? Hopefully that produces deterrence, which produces peace. And I think you'll hear the administration, you know, talking about peace through strength. And I think that's ultimately our goal. Nobody wants a war. But so we have to make sure they know that, hey, you don't want to mess with the United States of America's, you know, military force. And I think that fits us in good with the secretary's, his mission. His mission is revive the warrior ethos, rebuild the military, and reestablish deterrence by defending the homeland. So, you know, those fit right in, you know, with the whole Department of Defense, all the services, but it also fits in pretty nice with the National Guard. So we took that from higher and then we kind of build on what is, but getting down specific priorities for NCOs, you know, I think that's pretty easy for us too. Cause when you look at those things that we want to focus on, you know, lethality, you know, accountability, standards, readiness, you know, meritocracy, you know, you look at those things, I think those are things NCOs can focus on pretty easily. And that's kind of where I want to put them. But I want them to know where they're linked to all the way to the top, because if you know where those things are coming from, you know, they're, you know, hey, what's in the strategic documents, and you can link what you're doing down at the first line leader level. You know, I think it puts you in a pretty good place for success.
I wanted to ask you one thing here. It's a professional development thing, I would say. Sergeant Pena said that your favorite author is John Maxwell. Is there a book of his that you would recommend to the NCO Corps, and why?
Well, I think in order to be a good leader, in order to influence, we've already talked about that, you know, you have to be a good communicator. So I would say he's got several books, but I would say the 16 Undeniable Laws of Communication is one that I would recommend, not just NCOs, soldiers, officers. I would say everybody could benefit from reading, you know, that book and how he describes to be an effective communicator and the principles that he lays out. He's famous for numbering things. So he'll number all kind of things. You know, he's got all these laws. So he's got 16, you know, basically laws, principles of being an effective communicator. And I think if you want to be a good leader, you have to be a good communicator. Does that mean that you have to be used to speaking to, you know, audiences of, you know, 5,000 people, 4,000 people? No. But because that's, you know, it does not hurt, you know, and the higher you go, the more comfortable you ought to be with that. But if you just start with communicating to your battle buddy, now your fire team, now your squad, then your platoon, by the time you get there, you'll be pretty comfortable at communicating, which is influencing, you know, others to get after whatever the mission is at hand. You know, and I'll go back to the other piece too that I talked about earlier. You know, one of the things that he says is, and I may mess this up, but he says one of his quotes, and it's not an original quote. I think he got it from somebody else, but it says, nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And I think, you know, just picking up things like that from reading different books that he's written has served me well in my career.
The reason I bring it up, I mean, right now it's a big Army initiative, I guess, you know, reading, writing, professional discourse. I think it's important that NCOs not fall behind. Having recommendations like what you just provided, Sergeant Major or SEA, I think it's important for NCOs to be aware that there's things out there that's going to help them, not just them, but because we also have officers and civilian professionals, and I would say even some junior NCOs or soldiers who listen to our podcast. And I think it's important that they know that there's material out there that that'll help them grow professionally and personally, I would say, because I think leadership isn't just an Army thing. It's if you want to be successful at anything, being a good leader is going to help you succeed regardless.
Yeah, no doubt.
SEA, we have a final question that we always give on our Sergeant's Time podcast. What advice would present day you give to a newly promoted Sergeant John Raines back in the day?
You know, you just asked me about a book. I was not growing up in high school. I was in a big high school. My graduating class was about 800 people. And you can get lost in the classrooms that make up of, you know, a high school that big. So I don't think any of my teachers ever realized that I never read a book in high school. Not one book, you know. But hey, I passed, you know, I got my diploma. I would have started reading earlier. You know, it's hard to, there's all different kinds of ways to learn, but you know, I think reading and being a lifelong learner is important. And it's not that I wasn't doing any learning, you know, before I'd read a book, but I think the, you know, just how that can expound your knowledge and just give you a desire to continue to learn and be able to learn from greater audiences than just the people in your immediate proximity, I think is important. And when I think about how much I have to read now in my current job, and that goes for all the, you know, the members of the Senior Enlisted Council, which are our four-star CSMs, and, you know, and then select other members that round that out, I guarantee you that every one of us have to put a considerable amount of time into reading, you know, multiple things, you know, to include, you know, professional reading list, but not just that, just work becomes a lot of reading just to be able to keep up with what you're doing. And I'll tell you one that I like to quote, and I wouldn't have got this if I had not started reading. You know, I started reading in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. So that's the first book I had read. I just went, everybody knows how war is, you know, it's boredom and then times of intense, you know, just chaos. So during that boredom time, I just went and looked for the biggest book that I could find. And that was my first book that I read. I still have no idea what that book was about. It was not a very well written book, but I made it to the end because I kept thinking, hey, it's going to turn around next page. It's going to all come together. I finished that book. It never came together, but it made me become a reader. And I started reading, and it started that quest of just knowledge. And this is one I use a lot. It's leadership is all about people. It's not about plans. It's not about strategies. It is people motivating people to get the job done. You have to be people-centered. That come from, you know, one of our famous generals who became a chairman, that from General Colin Powell. Just being able to pick up little things like that and learn from them, you know, without having to know them, without being sitting next to them or without being in a classroom, I think is just valuable. So that's the thing that I would have told myself is, hey, start that sooner, you know, start reading sooner. It helps you be competent, helps you decide on what your course of action, how you want to go, which way you want to go. And it even gives you some ideas of the how to get there, to meet your goals.
Well, do you have anything else, Art Major? Anything that you wanted to discuss that maybe we didn't touch on, or anything that you have as a priority that you'd like to throw out there to the NCO Corps, or better yet, to the Army in general?
You know, if I had to throw anything out there, you know, it is the National Guard is 430,000 strong, 325,000 on the Army side, 105,000 on the Air Force side, and we are the best teammates on the planet. We are here to try to make, you know, the joint force better, and we're out there every day, you know, bringing all of these different skill sets that we have as citizen soldiers, citizen airmen, you know, to the team. So when you get a guardsman on your team, they may be an infantryman, they may be, you know, a commo guy, but they're probably also bringing another skill set to the team. And, you know, and I hope that we show that everywhere we go. I know I see it, and I get leaders, you know, tell me that all the time. And we are, you know, heavily engaged, heavily involved in everything that the Department of Defense has going on. And we're going to be whatever our country needs us to be when it comes to the National Guard.
Thank you, SEA, for joining us. And a thank you to our audience. Remember to put your knowledge to the page, submit articles, and get published with the NCO Journal. Don't forget to check out our webpage and follow us on social media. We'll catch you next time on the Sergeant's Time Podcast.